But I'm curious whether this computer is equipped with anti-original sin software to screen my slides.
No, it doesn't have that.
And therefore, I can't promise that it's. I can't promise that it's pure, but I'll do the best that I can and apologize in advance for any errors. I have no conflicts of interest to disclose. What is the brain? You might think that this slide depicts the mysterious relationship between the brain and the mind and all of its connections, material and immaterial, and the relationships between reason and decision and belief and intelligence and hope and doubt and so forth. But actually, this slide depicts what the brain looks like during jet lag. Having just crossed the Atlantic yesterday, this is a depiction of how my brain is functioning today. Maybe some of yours also. In the CBS series, 3 Pounds, a neurosurgeon in the program said, well, the brain is just wires in a box. That's all there is to it. But we can take that a step further scientifically and ask, well, how many wires? And what is their nature? How many synapses or connections between neurons are there in the human brain? The brain contains 100 billion neurons on average. Each one of them has 3,000 or more connections. That's 100 trillion, or 10 to the 14th synapses, which translates to an unfathomable number of functionally unique brain states. So we have a rich territory for investigation in science in the brain, and that's one of the reasons that I'm interested in neurology. I'm a clinical neurologist, and the brain just presents every new day is like a new day in medicine for me. I see problems I've never seen before or challenges that I haven't seen before, and the brain has an endless number of possibilities in terms of what we can do and think and envision as human beings. Just to give you a glimpse of how wonderful this is, the information capacity of the human brain is equivalent to 25 million books. Assuming that only 10% of your neurons are firing at any given time, which is just a guess, maybe not an accurate one, even that is 1,000 trillion computations per second, and each of these neurons is uniquely positioned. To quote Richard Swenson from his book, More Than Meets the Eye, God, it seems to me, really outdid himself in creating the human brain. So to comment on the brain, I might start with George Herbert, who said, oh, that thou shouldst give dust a tongue to cry to thee. Or quote from Shakespeare, there are more neurons in gray and white matter, Horatio, than I dreamt of in your philosophy. Or maybe not quite Shakespeare. I may have gotten him a little wrong there. But starting from a scientific perspective, science seeks to understand the brain, first of all, by examining it in greater and greater detail. And as we image the structure of brain, the X-ray machine gave us the ability to look through the skull in the living brain for the first time and to get some idea of the shadow of the texture of the brain. You could see the outlines of the ventricles, diagnose some brain tumors by the position of the pineal gland, which would shift if there was a mass lesion. And I'm just going to give you an overview of how far we've come in neuroimaging, which impacts what I do day to day. This was the first CAT scan in the United States at my institution in 1973, first applied to imaging the brain. This is the patient going in. You can see his face here. In the next slide, he's coming out of the CAT scanner. And I have to tell you that scans today don't take as long as they did in the early days. We can do a scan in about 10 minutes. I don't remember him having a beard when he went in. But they're a lot faster now. Not only faster, but better resolution. This is what the first CTs looked like, and this is a head CT in 2007. It's about 200 orders of resolution greater than the first scans. Compare that with the snowy black and white TV images that were available when television first came aboard to what we have now with HDTV. And looking even further, MRI, taking the resolution of the brain a step further, achieves images like this, which were just becoming available when I was in medical school and were breathtaking at the time. You could see so much detail of the structure of the brain. And this is some of the current higher resolution imaging that can visualize even the smallest blood vessels in the living brain. So that's structure. And what I'm interested in for this talk is brain function, because now we have a revolution in neuroimaging looking at the function of the brain, not only the structural arrangements, but what it's doing, how it's metabolizing, what parts of the brain are metabolizing. We have PET scans, positron emission tomography, that looks at anatomical areas related to metabolism. You have to give a radioisotope to do a PET scan. This is an example of localization of language function in the frontal and temporal lobes. You can dissect out what part of the brain is involved in interpreting and planning and then generating a speech response. Functional MRI takes that a step further and is more specific. You don't have to give a radioisotope. It takes advantage of the principle that if nerves start processing information, they require greater metabolic activity, and that is achieved by an increase in localized blood flow to that part of the brain. When you have more blood flow and more metabolism taking place, the neurons take oxygen from hemoglobin in the blood, and there's a conformational shift in the hemoglobin molecule as oxygen is dissociated, and that shift can be picked up by the MRI machine. So you can program the MRI machine, in a sense, to look at metabolic changes in the brain and thereby look at brain function. Some examples of what functional MRI can do. This is a subject looking at a specific visual stimulus, and you can see the calcarine cortex in the occipital lobe lighting up, processing what part of the brain is involved in interpreting a visual image. Similarly, short-term memory can be localized here to the hippocampus through an experiment designed to activate the part of the brain involved in short-term memory, and then you have the subject in a scanner at that moment. You can localize what part of the brain is involved in interpreting a human face, in this case the fusiform gyrus, right there, very specific information that could never be localized this precisely before the advent of functional imaging. And next to the fusiform gyrus are other parts of the brain associated with interpreting, not only recognizing the face, but interpreting what that face is expressing, the emotional content associated with particular types of facial expressions. You can start to look at what areas of the brain are involved in rendering those judgments. This is a very quick overview of what functional MRI can do. To look even further down the line of this talk, the implications for ethics, you can also image the moral parts of the brain with functional neuroimaging. What parts of the brain do we use to make moral judgments, to make ethical decisions, to evaluate ethical questions? If we can look at memory, movement, vision, language, why can't we look at moral reasoning too with the same tools? And in fact, functional MRI studies are localizing the physical substrates and the neural connections involved in emotion, moral intuition, reasoning, decision-making, and social attitudes, even biases of which we're unaware, can be picked up through imaging. Our life events, our personal events, social events, are tagged with specific emotions in the brain, and functional MRIs can pick up those relationships, depending on how the experiment is designed. And functional MRI studies have indicated in the realm of moral emotional cognition, activation of such structures as the amygdala, the thalamus, the upper midbrain, the occipital and medial prefrontal cortex, the superior temporal sulcus. Those of you who are not neuroscientists don't need to memorize those areas or know where they are, but I just want to give you kind of a bird's eye view of what is happening in this field. Because it's very, very interesting. It has implications for medicine, for science, for ethics, and theology. This is a picture of a functional MRI of a brain of a subject that's being shown pictures of moral violations, such as children abandoned in the streets and war scenes, physical assaults, etc. And so you can start to get an idea of what parts of the brain are interpreting those images and forming a judgment. Perhaps you've heard of Phineas Gage, the Burlington Railroad worker who had an accident in 1848. An explosion sent a tamping rod through his head. Before the accident, Gage had been capable and even-tempered. After the accident, he was fitful, irreverent, grossly profane, impatient, obstinate, capricious, and unable to commit to plans for future action. His friends even said that he was no longer Gage, not the Gage they knew. And this is how important the frontal lobes are for all of the capacities that Gage lost. Lesions in the frontal lobes result in indifference, impaired social judgment, etc. This is a functional MRI of a subject considering a moral question. You can see there's a lot of activity in the frontal lobes of the brain. With functional MRI, we can start to localize more specifically the attributes that Gage had impairment in. You can even make fine distinctions, such as this experiment, which was able to distinguish the ethical process of choosing the better of two goods from choosing the lesser of two evils, a fine distinction in ethics. And you can even sort that out anatomically, comparing the activity in the ventromedial prefrontal cortex to that in the dorsal anterior cingulate gyrus. That's the level of precision. There was even an experiment published localizing altruism. Did you know that altruism is right here in the brain? Or maybe it's more complicated than that. And I was struck by how small the area of altruism is in the brain. And perhaps the real message is we need more altruism. So I'll give you an ethics case. We have to have a case discussion for an ethics lecture. You're taking a break from the ASACIS meeting in Edinburgh. You awaken from your nap in the basement to notice that a furnace fire has broken out. The smoke is profuse. You trigger the fire alarm, but help is not expected to arrive for at least 30 minutes. The festival's about to take place, a lot of activity in town. Deadly fumes, meanwhile, are pouring into this building, into the ventilation system, supplying these three lecture halls. In room A, 50 people are attending the session on theology and modern science. In room B, 10 people remain at the end of the session on appropriate technology. If you do nothing, the fumes will spread through the ventilation ducts directly into the lecture room A and cause the deaths of 50 scientists. The only way to avoid their deaths is to hit a certain switch right in front of you, which will redirect the flow of the ventilation system, causing the fumes to bypass lecture room A. As a result of doing this, the fumes will instead enter lecture room B, containing the 10 scientists, causing their deaths. Should you hit the switch and prevent the deaths of the 50 by causing the deaths of the 10? These are the kind of questions that ethicists wrestle with. Fortunately, they're not everyday real-life questions for most of us. But like a scientific experiment, they reduce a complex question to something that can be defined and measured. If you're not sure how to decide, then perhaps neuroscience can help you. Would you be willing to make your decision inside this functional MRI scanner? And that's exactly what these researchers at Princeton, Cohen and Green and others, did. With that type of dilemma, the classic example is known as the trolley dilemma, in which you have to choose whether to save five people by killing one by hitting a switch that redirects a trolley. Another example is the footbridge dilemma, where you have to decide whether to push someone over a bridge to a very large person in this model that would stop the trolley and avoid the deaths of the five people on the track. These are two similar dilemmas, but there is a distinction between them. One involves throwing a switch. The other involves actually pushing somebody. The pushing is a more personal act, and that's the moral distinction between the two. The outcome is the same, isn't it? They were able to tell. Most say yes, by the way, to the first, and most say no to the second. Isn't that interesting? Should we screen physicians on the basis of how they answer that dilemma? So they were able to distinguish moral personal versus moral impersonal dilemmas and were able to identify specific brain areas. It's not important for now which they are, but they're able to distinguish where that personal moral act of pushing the person enters into the equation of ethical reasoning. The two messages from this experiment: there are systematic variations in the engagement of emotion in moral judgment, and they can be measured. And emotionally incongruent responses took longer. It took the people who were hesitant about pushing the person in front of the train longer to decide. And so I asked, well, if we were to use functional or neuroimaging to help us decide what is right and wrong ethically, would we look for patterns that are more coherent, where the answer seems to be simple, where the brain areas are easy to define? Would that be right? Or would it be right to look at the brain patterns that look more confused, the answers that take longer? Is the brain that hesitates a more confused brain, or is it a more thoughtful brain? And those types of assumptions are going to go into the interpretation of this research as it moves on. We can quickly map out what parts of your brain are involved in the ethical question that I presented. Long-term memory is called into play in many areas of the cerebral cortex, recalling the images of fire and burn victims, which you need to have that context available to decide how important it is to respond to this fire. Recalling the layout of, I got the building wrong, of the John McIntyre Center, wherever we are, there are mirror neurons in the inferior parietal lobule. You didn't know you had those, some of you, did you? But remember where they are in case you need them, in case someone asks you. That allow you to develop a sense of sympathy for colleagues at risk and imagines their facial expressions, their experiences in dealing with the fire. We model other people in our brains. The amygdala processes the fear that the victims may experience and your own in the face of threat. The premotor cortex then rehearses what you might do, how you might run up those stairs, how you might get to the phone. It tells the brain how to activate the muscles that will be needed to enact whatever your decision is. The hypothalamus generates an autonomic response that allows you to increase your blood pressure, your heart rate to respond to the emergency. The frontal lobes and anterior cingulate cortex stifle the urge to flee and assert self-control so that you can master the situation and not just run away from it. The prefrontal cortex, in collaboration with many other areas, reasons among the options you have, plans your actions. So there's quite a lot going on in the brain. It's not even just the little areas that experiment from Princeton outlined. There are many other questions you could ask about addressing this dilemma and start to understand the neural pathways that subserve that reasoning process. How might you set up the fMRI experiment to look at this ethical dilemma, another 50 versus 10 deaths dilemma? You remember the conversation that Abraham had with the Lord over whether to destroy the city of Sodom. Sodom. This is the picture that I took of Sodom in 1998. I guess there weren't 10 people there after all worth saving. But it's a similar dilemma. And there's even more going on in this conversation, perhaps, than there was over the fire dilemma or the trolley dilemma. What a challenge for fMRI if you could capture all of the meaning of this conversation. I have to conclude that there are some questions that can't be answered either by Google or by neuroimaging in this case, although there are a lot of questions that we will be able to answer with greater and greater resolution. There are empirical limitations, just to point out, of how far we can go in drawing conclusions from fMRI. These experiments are highly crafted. There's a lot of planning, a lot of analysis that goes into generating the algorithms that compare the brain images before and after. The reference data that's used may be incomplete or simplified for some purposes. It's heavily dependent on the experimental conditions. Particular mental states may not correlate with regional hypermetabolism, which fMRI measures. Two examples may be some processes involved in moral judgments may involve deactivating groups of neurons rather than activating them. Or there may be so few involved for some decisions that it may not show up. There may not be enough of a change in metabolic activity per unit volume to measure. Correlations do not always imply causation, and not all real-life mental tasks can be experimentally duplicated. So how should the brain reason? How can neuroimaging inform our judgment? Reason is the basis of how we all form consensus in bioethics. It's unambiguous. It's an exact language for the most part. Its presuppositions are usually defined or can be. Its conclusions tested analytically, confirmed against empirical data. It demands consistency, coherence, and efficiency. It's trustworthy. I agree. We depend on reason in science, but is it complete? There was an interesting article by Ruth Macklin in one of the bioethics journals last year, arguing that conservative bioethicists, as she called them, rejected rational arguments and appealed instead to the authority of moral intuition. Mystical and emotional assertions, she insists, are not arguments and should be discounted in public reasoning. Is she right or is she wrong? She contrasts her view with Yuval Levin, who wrote in a previous article that in addition to reason, there are moral truths that are reasonable but not fully rational, that can be understood but not adequately articulated. And these are the realms, he says, where many ethical limits express themselves not in syllogisms but in shudders. I think this is one of the realms that is difficult to analyze through functional MRI. He's reminding us that there are additional ways of knowing, that the language of reason, hence also the brain pathways that process reason, may be inadequate to articulate. And there are glimpses of truth that intuition provides us that we may not be aware of how we got there. There is, in the brain, what C.S. Lewis called a liaison between cerebral and visceral man, which we might localize to the orbitofrontal cortex. It's the interface of emotion and cognition. We have various parts of the brain involved in emotional decisions and emotional judgments, and that combines with other parts of the brain that process reason, and they come together in the brain, and somehow a decision emerges from those two sets of pathways. That is going to be an exciting frontier for neuroscience. I'll summarize by saying the prefrontal cortex cannot say to the amygdala, "I have no need of you." I think there's a temptation in neuroethics to hasten to a conclusion that we understand how moral reasoning occurs because we've identified these pathways correlating with reason. And I think that in neuroethics, as in all of science, one discovery doesn't satisfy the explanation. It leads to more questions. There's a wide open frontier of truth and of moral reasoning in the brain that's going to take us a very long time to comprehend. Neuroscience is descriptive. Ethics is not only descriptive, it's normative. There's a different dimension between how things are and what happens in the brain and, on the other hand, how we ought to think and ought to behave. A different dimension than any form of neuroimaging can prove. In the interest of time, I'm going to pass over more clarification of that to remind everyone. Malcolm Jeeves, who I met through this organization, I haven't seen him at this meeting yet, reminds us that every advance in neuropsychology tightens the link between mind and brain. And brain things may not be, though, all of what they first appear to be. I like this illusion. If you stare at it, the black holes appear to be empty at first. I'm going to go right to what I want to say, that it is not good for man to be alone. The Lord invites us to reason together, and this is the most profound thing. We have to combine our reductionistic understanding of the brain with our awe of the fact that that God, whose mind is infinitely greater than ours, is still able to communicate and relate to us with our limited brains, as fantastic and complex as they are. It's a great mystery that he can communicate to us, that he chooses to communicate to us. And beyond the question of what is the mind of a human being, what is the mind of God, and how can we describe the relationship between the two? For my thoughts are not your thoughts, neither are my ways your ways my ways, declare the Lord. As the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts than your thoughts. Isaiah 55. So above the reach of neuroimaging is what St. Augustine said, that within every man there is a God-shaped void, only symbolically represented here. Thou hast created us for thyself, and our brains, are restless until they rest in Thee. Thank you.
We do have time for some questions. Before we start, though, I heard yesterday that Malcolm Jeeves actually won't be here because his wife took a nasty fall earlier in the week and he's at home looking after her.
Oh.
Yes.
So you talked about the imaging. You presented a dilemma. I was wondering about the time lapse between that. So I oftentimes, if I have something where I have to make a decision, I can make a decision when I'm expected to react in a few moments. But then if I go away and I reflect upon it, I sometimes come to a different conclusion. And so have you done any studies over time lapse of how the brain functions and how you come to decisions?
I'll repeat the question since we're being recorded. You're pointing out a very good observation that if you are forced to make an immediate decision and then later have time to reflect on it, you may come to a completely different decision. I think that may be an additional weakness of these types of functional MRI studies. As good as they are, they force you to make a decision while you're in the scanner under a certain time frame. And that's not necessarily the best decision or the one that you would prefer if given more time. Now, it would be much harder to design an experiment where you would study what the brain is doing in making a decision that requires time. I talked with someone earlier today who said to me that when I make an important decision, I like to take at least a few weeks to reflect on it. You can't design a functional MRI experiment that will monitor everything the brain does in a few weeks' time. Yes, sir.
Can I ask you to say a little more about the difference between what you call bioethics and moral judgments and altruism? It seems to me that the trolley experiments and the throwing of the switch about the ventilator really put somebody in an objective position in which they're thinking about extent of good or bad for different groups of people, which doesn't really affect them. Whereas altruism, as I understand it, is going to cost me something. It's when I, in the words of Scripture, decide that I am going to treat my neighbor the way I would like to be treated, and that will actually give him benefit and will cost me something. Now, presumably that's quite difficult to do under an MRI, but is this area of altruism, can you separate it from what you were broadly talking about as bioethics and morality and say something about it as altruism?
Your question is, what can we say about altruism, which you correctly point out is a different realm than the trolley experiment addresses. Perhaps if we redesigned the trolley experiment where the observer had to throw himself in front of the train, that could be a model for altruism. But that's impossible to duplicate in the laboratory in an abstract circumstance where there's no real cost to the person making the decision. In fact, you're only looking at an abstract model with cartoon figures in making the judgment. In real life, you may approach that situation very differently. So altruism is, as you say, difficult, perhaps impossible to study adequately through neuroscientific means. And so we need additional resources to help us understand what altruism should be. Yes, Dennis.
Bill, it seems to me that one other limitation of the trolley experiment would be that you're assuming that your volunteers are all at the same level in terms of their moral backgrounds. Would you care to speculate on what moral formation or religious training bearing that might have with one volunteer as opposed to another volunteer who doesn't have that?
You're asking what the moral background is of the subjects in this experiment, and as I recall, that wasn't looked at very carefully. So it would be interesting to make comparisons or correlate why people answer the way they do based on their previous experiences. But it immediately gets extraordinarily complex, doesn't it?
They have looked at prisoners contra others' activity in the prefrontal cortex is much lower. People who haven't developed delay of gratification and so on than people who have been trained. So there are.
Yes, sir. There have been experiments looking at prisoners and frontal lobe activity, and it's a classic chicken and egg problem. Do people end up in prison because they have inadequate resources to make responsible judgments and to live responsible lives, and they get into trouble? Or do people who get into trouble then suffer brain injury because they're in fights or drink a lot of alcohol, which also can damage the frontal lobes? And as in all things, it's probably both. Yes, ma'am.
FMR recently has been used to tell the difference between minimal consciousness and persistent vegetative states in comatose patients, right?
It has. I've not followed that literature, but you're correct. FMRI has been one of the tools that's been used to define the minimally conscious state.
Yeah, so my question is, should we be doing more of that, and how receptive is our society to that use of technology, because it forces us to redefine the value of life? The person looks comatose but actually comprehends spoken language. Shouldn't that change how we treat people who look, have just emerged from a massive brain injury, and should we be using more of that technology and change the way we treat people?
I agree. It's a field ripe for research. It's very technically difficult and demanding to do these studies. And so it may not end up being a tool that would be applicable for routine clinical use. But certainly we can extrapolate the results and learn a lot about how reliable our bedside exams and other studies are.
We have one question in the back and then two over here.
Okay.
Yes.
It's very nice to be able to locate, say, altruistic activity in the brain to region A or something like this.
That's obviously an oversimplification, as I think you're suggesting.
Is there any hope of taking the next step? Why is it located in A as opposed to B, perhaps in a different individual? Is there any hope of understanding organically the difference between area A and area B with respect to their various functions?
So the question is there any hope in understanding the difference between area A and area B in different subjects? Yes, the fact that you can identify consistent changes across the population does have some value, and as you suggest, it's probably not the whole explanation, but it's one clue to put into the puzzle of interpretation. There were two questions over here. Yes, ma'am.
This is a comment with regard to brain scans and altruism. My colleague Warren Brown and some other scientists at Caltech are designing an experiment where there's something like a card game a group of people are playing, and you can set it up so that if a person chooses, he or she can lose more money for him or herself, but the result will be that everybody else gets more as a consequence. And if you do that with a large enough number of people, you will find some who will make those sacrifices for the benefit of the group. And they've got a plan to actually pick out some of the people, choose some of the people who will do that, and then compare them with a control group using the brain scans to see if any differences show up.
So that everyone hears, your colleague Warren Brown, yes, in California, is arranging experiments looking at card games and identifying people who make altruistic choices in the card games, which actually benefit the whole community of players. Mm-hmm. And in order to, if you select out who those people are, you're probably looking at habitual responses. I would wonder if that's any different than the naive response of someone who consciously chooses to behave that way, as opposed to just following a practice of behaving that way.
Yeah.
That's a very good point.
I think Dennis is next.
Yeah, I think this sort of rapid response unit, sort of moral decision making that you are really doing the brain imaging on, is very interesting and really fascinating, and it's great for experimentalists to do that. But I suppose, and I think it was already alluded to before, that most of our moral reasoning isn't like that. In fact, you know, most of the moral decisions we make are actually not these immediate reactions. They're good for survival, they're good for group cohesion and all those things, and you can see how they could evolve. But actually, they're generally rather slow processes. And I suppose my question really is, I mean, will it not turn out to be the case that those sort of brain imaging processes, if you can do brain imaging over those sort of moral reasoning processes, they would just look pretty much the same as reasoning about your latest scientific experiment or your theory, or about how you're going to vote in the next election, or in other words, that neuroethics wouldn't look any different. I mean, if you think about brain imaging, it wouldn't look any different, actually, from any other frontal lobe processes where you have to cogitate and weigh out things and so forth. So actually, this field is a little bit on a tangent. I'm sort of playing devil's advocate here, because they're actually misled by the stuff you can do in the lab happens to be this very important kind of rapid response unit. But actually, most moral reasoning isn't like that at all. Therefore, the field is a bit sort of off on a tangent here. Just because of the technology, this is what you have to do. I'd be interested to hear what you
say. That's very well said, and I'm not sure I can summarize it as well, but the rapid moral response unit, as you say, that we're imaging, is what you can visualize in a short-term experiment. But our really important moral decisions usually take much longer, as you say, or much more difficult to capture. And it may be that what we're imaging is a tool or a resource within the brain that we use not only with moral decision-making, but also in other ordinary decisions that we might make throughout the day in regard to research or having breakfast, whatever it may be. We may use those systems for a variety of purposes, and that may be just one component of the moral reasoning process.
I think we're... there could be endless questions on this topic. Why don't we adjourn now and have some private discussion on this? I'm sure our speaker will be willing to entertain some more questions.
It's nice to have a lot of questions, isn't it?